unpack your knives, and stay for the Top Chef Judges Roundtable Podcast here on Reality TV, where Hap-Up's a subsidiary of RHAP, but in this case, the P stands for Party Boat, baby! Hey, everybody, Mike Bloom here, back to talk about Episode 8 of Top Chef Kentucky. Let me bring in my fellow party planning committee, who's here to plan this jaunt that hopefully you will all enjoy. Antonio Mazzaro, will this be a kegger or a trivia-filled romp?
Why can't it be both, Mike? What's wrong with both? Why can't you have trivia kegger? That sounds like something I know another co-host of this podcast would probably like to attend, at least one of them.
Yes, the man whose nickname was Jiggle Juice in college, Kurt Clark. Kurt, how are you?
Bringing the Placid to RHAP. I would definitely know which of the two teams I would have been a part of. And when Michelle said the trivia party, I'm like, yes. and then I would have been eliminated.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was the Kurt Clark of party. Just very, inoffensive.
Oh, my middle name is Game Night, so.
And, of course, we are here with Haley Strong. Haley, are you ready to take this thing out on the water?
Pack me up in a doggy bag and bring me along.
She puts the puppy chow into RHAP.
I put the crunch in the key lime crunch.
Interesting. Okay. Not entirely sure what that means, but maybe we'll dig a bit deeper into that metaphor. But before we get into all the stuff that happened over the course of this episode, I do want to bring things down a bit, because as of the time of recording this, we're recording this on Saturday, January 26th. Yesterday, on January 25th, we did lose a bright light in the Top Chef community. Fatima Ali, who, as those of you that might remember, was on Top Chef Colorado last season, who ended up being the fan favorite, made it all the way to seventh place. For those of you that might not necessarily know the story, essentially, Fatima, while the season was airing, was diagnosed with a form of sarcoma. And she ended up getting it removed, and it seemed like the cancer was gone, but it ended up, unfortunately, coming back several months later. Doctors had given her only about a year or so to live. If you've been following her story, she published this article in, I think, Healthiest. Maybe I can link to it in the show notes, where she sort of talked about how she's going to use this opportunity to capitalize on things that she's always wanted to do, and she's really shown that through her social media, if anybody's been following her. Unfortunately, she did end up losing the battle with cancer yesterday and passing away. And it's a horrible, horrible loss for the community. I loved Fatima to death. And to have her smile so much in the face of adversity, both in and out of the game, is, for lack of a better term, inspirational. I don't know how much you three have to say on it, but I guess I will open the floor a bit to see if any of you have remarks to honor Fatima at this time.
Yeah, she was such a shining light to anybody who seemingly knew her, or anybody who I know. Haley, you loved her on the show so much, and
she was just the best. She was everything I wanted from a cast member. You know, she was so much fun. She just brought such a joy to the show, and I'm so, so sad about this.
Yeah, it's something that we knew was coming, because she was so forthright about what she was going through. She had a lot of great writing that she put out. Mike, you talked about the article that she wrote, but she also has one coming out in Bon Appetit magazine that they have now tweeted, and you can get online at their website, bonappetit.com. That's just a piece that she wrote, and I have a feeling we will see some of the other products of the choices that she was making when she got her diagnosis. She was writing down a recipe a day. She was working closely with her family, and she was doing a lot of introspective writing and thinking, because she knew what was ahead of her. And it's she faced it with such grace and strength. And there's so much to be gained from that. But I think really the way she lived her life and everything she did once she was diagnosed speaks to this idea that we are not promised to tomorrow. And you should not put off till tomorrow the things that you think you want to accomplish. You should go for them, and you should live your life the way you can in pursuit of those things. And she really spoke to that so beautifully and with such grace. Cancer has probably touched all of our lives in some way. So I'm sure there are ways each of us or anyone who's listening can localize this to our own lives. But she's somebody who was a shining example for, I know, so many around the world, not just in the United States. You look at the hashtag on Twitter, or you look at her name on Twitter when it was trending, and you could see tributes coming in from all over the world because she was Pakistani and she grew up there. So she was an inspiration as a female Pakistani chef to so many people. It really is just horrible, a horrible loss, and somebody who's life we really should pay tribute to in the ways that she wrote about and in the way she did. So very sad to see her go. Sorry to rant on there.
Oh no, not at all. I mean, it's we kind of you know joke on the podcast that I have goldfish memory, and you know, once a season's done, I really don't remember much about it. But even now, just us talking about it, I remember like on the show how important it was to her to represent her culture and her food, and to like really have that showcased, and to kind of, like you said, make that mark as a Pakistani chef, and just like really representing, you know, her culture in her food and in her tradition. And so, and my, you know, limited interaction with her myself was on Twitter, but like even just the support that she gave us was really welcome. So she will definitely be missed.
And I think if you want any indication about how there is the old adage that a top chef cast becomes a family, and as trite as it may be, look no further than how the Colorado cast has really rallied around her. You know, even with her initial diagnosis, there were numerous times where cast members visited her. They made GoFundMes. They did events in honor of her, to the point where even a couple weeks ago, if you're following a bunch of these chefs on Instagram, a bunch of them got together for a bit of what they call a bittersweet reunion in LA in her honor. And so it really touches my heart as well to see not only how much we as a community, to your point, Antonio, have been affected, enlightened by Fatima's presence, but the fact that, you know, these other 14, 15 people that she worked with as well and worked so closely with, how much she clearly touched all their lives as well. And she is gone, but she is definitively not forgotten in so many ways. There'll be more stuff coming out, as Antonio has said before. And of course, our thoughts and prayers go out to her family at this time. She will be missed. Absolutely. So let's steer the boat. Let's get into this episode. Whatever floats your boat. As alluded to at the end of the last episode, we are going to Lake Cumberland. Apparently, Kentucky has more shoreline than the entire state of Florida. Antonio, as our resident Kentucky expert, did you know any of these like big time facts about how much Kentucky loves the water?
You do hear a lot of these facts. You hear like Kentucky has more navigable water miles than any state other than Alaska. Or you hear the things about shoreline. It is a state that is full of streams and rivers and certainly some lakes. In Lake Cumberland's case, it's a TVA man-made lake, if you will. So there are a lot of things like that throughout this region. Tennessee is full of them as well. So some of these lakes aren't natural. And so maybe if that is a title that Kentucky has, we do have a false claim to it. But Lake Cumberland is, I think it was a very accurately represented here. Maybe a little undersell on the party aspect. Other than that, very accurately represented.
Can you talk to me a bit more about that? You made some allusions to it at the end of last podcast, but I want to hear more about this rampant houseboat scene. You know, I grew up in southwestern Connecticut, which had its own little bit of shoreline experience, but I'll admit it's probably a bit more bougie than the houseboat party of it all. So I would just love to hear you wax profound about the scene on Lake Cumberland.
Well, like, for example, just Google, if you're out there listening and you want to go to YouTube or just wherever, Google Lake Cumberland poker run. Does any of the three of you know what a poker run is, period?
No, but I wouldn't yeah, like put too much stock in the fact that I don't know what something is. So.
Well, I mean, I don't know how rampant these are around the country, but a poker run is essentially a pub crawl or a bar crawl where you're picking up cards at all your stops and trying to create the best poker hand. But if you look at like Lake Cumberland poker run, what you see is just these boats that are all lined up and organized and connected so that you have what you essentially did a little mini version of here, which is what you had was like four boats side to side. But like if you really look up what what goes on at Lake Cumberland. These kind of parties are the norm there. Houseboats very much are part of that culture, a huge part of the culture. I'm sure like in Arizona, like Lake Havasu, I think that's in Arizona, or places like that, they have these huge lake parties as well. But it is definitely massive in Kentucky at Lake Cumberland. A lot of, you can't grow up here and not have had somebody have some event there, whether it's a bachelor party or whether it's some kind of birthday party or somebody's cousin has an event or a house or something like that. So it's definitely a big deal. I think pretty fairly represented here. The big boats with the slides into the water and the galleys and the sleeping quarters. I mean, that's something that most people, I think, who live in Kentucky or grew up here have probably experienced in some way, shape, or form. And then as far as Sarah's claim about the shoreline, I don't know. I mean, we have a lot of rivers, a ton of streams. We have a ton of like water miles that you can take a boat on. I think the state is bordered on three sides by rivers in some ways. So it's a lot. There's a lot of water here for sure. I think this is a pretty fair representation of what goes on.
I'm intrigued by this poker run because it seems like the alcoholic version of the Monopoly game at McDonald's, where it's like just keep going places and getting little tokens and eventually you'll get a winning hand.
It is, and the mafia runs it as well, so it's yeah. Perfect.
Or you can just play 52 pickup and end up with alcohol poisoning. Kurt, you come from the Midwest, which, as Justin talked about, does have, you know, its land of lakes, not to be confused with the butter. Do you have any experience with houseboats or boat parties at all?
I grew up on, I pretty much almost always lived near the shores of Lake Michigan, which is like too big to really have, large, parties like this. It's more like, I mean, there was like Lake Muskegon and Silver Lake and smaller lakes. Like, I mean, I'd say like, I've even heard a stat that in Michigan, where I grew up and spent a good deal of my life, like you're never more than half a mile away from a body of water, wherever you are in Michigan. So we have our own little questionable facts as well. No, I've not had a houseboat party experience at all. I do have cousins that live in Kentucky, and I alluded to last week, the last podcast, that there was a party that was going on there that my cousins ran regarding the eclipse viewing. But otherwise, no, I pretty much just do beach parties and not houseboat parties.
Haley, you are a socialite. Have you done any?
Wow.
I don't want to project. I don't want to project.
I feel like you're projecting. I haven't left my house all week.
a seasonal socialite.
Yeah, exactly. When it's warm outside during the 3 weeks in Canada where it is above freezing. Have you ever attended one of these a houseboat party or a party on the water at all?
No, clearly I don't have the right friends.
That's yeah.
Like I'm you're not the only ones who live near lakes. I live in Niagara, sandwiched by two of the greatest lakes in all time, Ontario and Erie. But no, like seriously, like I live right smack dab in the middle. And for the last couple of years, my parents' place is right on Lake Erie, so we'd go to the beach. And I'd be jealous of like the people who like even have like their tiny little speedboat just like tied down close to the edge of the beach, and they're all like having a Coors and stuff. I'm like, damn, I wish I had some cool friends who had a boat, but I don't. So,
well, now you can maybe reach out to Justin. Maybe you can, meet somewhere in the middle.
I'd reach out to Justin
of the Great Lakes, and because apparently he loves throwing parties, especially when his parents were out of town. Kurt, does Justin seem like that type of guy to you who was always hosting the party on the weekends?
I don't know, because if you're hosting the party, that doesn't free you up to hit multiple parties yourself, which actually seems to me to be Justin's speed. But I definitely don't doubt his claim that he knows parties, whether he's throwing them, whether he's attending them and taking notes so that he can throw them later. He would have been potentially one of my first picks if I had to draft a party planning chef testant committee.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because there's one chef testant who does get that opportunity to draft. Eddie, as the winner of the previous elimination challenge, gets the ability to, essentially draft his team for this elimination challenge, which, for those of you that might not remember, the chefs are divided into two teams, one of five and one of four, to create two competing houseboat parties on Lake Cumberland for 100 guests. And Eddie, in true Eddie fashion, he was hitting a real high, and just any amount of pressure that went his way had him crumble a bit as he decides to literally pick his team by just sort of looking around the room, he ends up choosing Adrian, Michelle, David, and Brian. And the edit made us believe that he seemingly accidentally neglected, I think, some of the four vivacious party-going spirits and designated them to the other team. Before we get into that, Antonio, let's sort of put on our reality TV expert caps here. We don't talk a lot about strategy in Top Chef, but from a decision-making standpoint, is it more advantageous to have to be on a team of five chefs or four chefs in this scenario?
There certainly are ups and downs in terms of the space, and I think that's what Adrian immediately points to. But I think the underreported part of this is if Eddie were picking strategically, he certainly seemingly picked a few chefs, or at least a couple chefs, that I think he thought he could beat. And I think that is the real key part of this is, you know, that the losing team is going to go to judges' table. And that means that you might not have the worst dish of the day and you might still go home because the worst dish could be on the winning team. So what you probably want to do if you're Eddie is put yourself in a position where you know you're not going to go home, regardless of whether your team wins or loses the challenge. And so the way you do that is you put yourself on a team with people that you think you can beat. Now, if that's what Eddie did or if that's what is reflected here, I cannot speak to that, but I think there is something to be said for that. And maybe by putting five people on your team, you increase the possibility that somebody will cook a dish that's worse than yours. And so I don't know if that went into his thinking, but I think generally speaking, I think you probably want to go with raw numbers here because it's also advantageous to have more hands in the kitchen, right, Kurt?
Yeah. It's I was thinking that as well. And like the one downside I saw was the literally too many cooks in the kitchen in terms of the sheer space, as you had pointed out, as Adrian had pointed out. But like my thinking was, if you want to increase the chances that you're going to stay, you're going to basically want to increase the chances, increase the size of the potential other people who will be going home. Especially, did he pick the right five? Did he pick the right team of five? Did he pick the right additional four people? That's, I think, what the question is. But I think going with a team of five versus a team of four, I probably would have done the same thing in this situation just from a sheer strategy and survival perspective.
Yeah, not to mention that I think that there's a lot of stuff going on day of. I mean, it's not restaurant wars level, but we even see, due to logistics that are out of their control, there's a lot of running around. You have to have people sort of like filling in for each other. So I think it makes sense to have that extra set of hands, even though it doesn't really work out at the end, again, due to those extenuating circumstances. But Haley, give me your thoughts on the actual picks that Eddie made, whether or not they were strategic.
You know, we're at a point in the competition where I feel like any team he created would have been like a really good team. And yes, it happened that the four hardcore party people were on the other team. But I don't think Eddie made like a bad team. And like, it worked out, the fact that Adrian got really sick, that he did have the extra person. So I can't say he made like a bad decision with his team. Like, I feel like it could have gone either way. Not like in the way that the episode played out. Like, I feel like it was very clear, but in the beginning, it could have gone either way.
Well, let's start moving into the planning for this, because you guys talked about this last week. Tom seems to have this moment, I think, like once every season now. We had it last season too, where he essentially sort of like shakes the chefs and says, snap out of it. And I think that everyone is trying to work on the epiphany of the quote unquote cook you mentality that Tom put out there at the last judges table due to the vast majority of them failing on the meat challenge. And we'll see that obviously inform the green team's suggestions in terms of how they want to prepare their food. But Antonio, on the whole, what do you think the range was in terms of people actually utilizing this advice practically?
The point I think is a good one that has been made. I think certain chefs were struggling with this more than others. For example, I think Kelsey has been cooking Kelsey all season long, and I think doing a great job of it. And I think certainly she continues to do that this challenge, and we'll definitely talk about what that looks like. But it is not something I think she has not been doing. So while I think we could say like, oh man, Kelsey did so great this time, and look what she did. She cooked Alabama. She wasn't afraid to put out something like the puppy chow, even though it might not always fit in the Top Chef realm. So she really took that to heart. I would say she's already been doing that all season long. And in some cases, maybe too much. Like maybe she was a little too delicate for example, last week with the meat, but I think she's been cooking her food all season long. So I don't think she needed that advice. The chef we really saw get that advice and maybe need it was Brian, right? And Brian was the one who maybe wanted to be a little too delicate and not just, he was too afraid to cook the kind of food he usually cooks. And did he take that advice to heart this episode and cook the way he cooks? If he did it go very well for him? Like, I don't know. So I'm not sure. This seems like a mixed bag for me. I didn't see a ton of bravery from these chefs in this episode, but I'm also not sure the challenge really allowed for it. This was a make a party dish or a party meal, something that would go good on a boat party. I didn't give the best opportunity for these chefs to cook themselves. Although I think we saw it again from Eric, but Eric's been doing it too. So I think the chefs who need that advice have always been doing it anyway.
Yeah, it's strange. It's almost like getting that advice right before this challenge emboldened the second team, the party team, to let loose a little bit more and have fun in terms of like their planning for the party, but not necessarily in showcasing their dishes. I mean, there was one guest, and you know, that guest wasn't a judge and it was anecdotal, but there's one guest who said, well, you know, the one team's boat was definitely more fun, but the other team, I liked their food better. But in either case, it's not really necessarily embracing the advice that Tom gave. I don't think that people were cooking scared necessarily, but I didn't see anything that was really fully showcasing everybody's talents.
Yeah, this challenge, the way that it turned out, actually really reminded me of that episode of The Office, the Christmas episode where they have the two separate parties, where the green team is like the Pam and Karen side, right? Where they're a bit more raucous, they have the alcohol. The blue side is the Angela and Phyllis party, where they have the better food, but my God, is it droll. And so I guess it just really depends on, you know, what your fancy is. Haley, do you have a preference?
Yeah, I think I would prefer going to the more fun party. It just had a...
You prefer fun?
It just had a better atmosphere. And I got to say, this was probably my favorite episode of the season so far. I feel like even though the blue team party was a little like more chill, both teams seemed to be having a lot of fun. They were cooking with joy, and I just really enjoyed the episode.
Yeah, to that point, I think that for the criticisms about how maybe this, we have not really gotten to know a lot about this cast, or there's not really anyone to swing the rootability, as it were, and when it comes to fan favoritism, I do feel like we got to see these chefs a bit more, I wouldn't say in their element, because I think as you guys were saying, this isn't necessarily the best test of a chef's cookery, but it at least gave them a bit of time to showcase their personality. And honestly, we're more than halfway through the season. I think we personally need it. Antonio, I think you're probably along with Haley in terms of picking the green team of the party you would rather attend.
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is, even a soiree on Lake Cumberland is usually a kegger. Like, it's not... That's a party place. And I know I keep beating that drum, and I'm sure people are sick of it at this point, but that's how you have a boat party. I appreciate what the blue team was doing, and they looked absolutely miserable. Even when they were preparing, they had the generator problems. They had all these issues, but they just looked like they weren't having as much fun as the green team. The green team really came into this with clear eyes and full hearts. And as a result, they couldn't lose. I think it also helped that I really threaded that needle, didn't I, Haley?
I had emergency lights because the generator was
I really thought that it probably helped to have Sarah on their team as well. That to me is the major sin for Eddie, is not picking the local that gives you the home court advantage.
That's a great point. See, I would have gone to the green team was the party team, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so I would have gone to the green team's boat, and then my social battery would have drained very quickly, and I would have gone over to the blue team's boat. And then I would have enjoyed the food, and then their attitude and, like you said, it's a demeanor, probably would have drained me in a different way, and I would have gone to recharge. So I would have bounced back and forth like this perpetual motion food consumption machine, and just cycled through both. So I actually would have, I wouldn't have voted. There would have been 99 votes instead of 100, and that way there wouldn't have been a tie if that was even a possibility. So
I think you just described my life cycle, other than the not voting part.
constantly moving between food places to consume energy, yes, and then just sort of to perpetually keep moving.
Profound, Kurt.
It's moving away from the situation that pulls my battery in the direction it doesn't need to go.
All right, well, let's get on to Lake Cumberland. Actually, before we move on, Antonio, I do want to bring up something you brought up to us before the recording, and I don't want to make you put your Conspirapod host hat back on here, but I heard there are some urban legends around Lake Cumberland where the rest of this episode is going to take place. Can you disclose some of those to us?
Shout out to Andrea Reichenbach at PrimWinnie on Twitter, who messaged me. She used to live in Somerset. She worked at the Harbor at Lee's Ford, which is the restaurant at the marina there. One I've been to. Andrea and I have probably crossed paths and not realized it. And she said there are a couple urban legends about the lake. For one, as I said earlier, Lake Cumberland is a man-made lake, a TVA lake. So there is a small town at the bottom of the lake. It's called Old Burnside that was flooded to build the lake. And people say that there are weird things floating to the surface of the lake from this old town. I feel like this is how the book World War Z starts, with looting of some flooded town that leads to some virus. So I would discourage anyone from Lake Cumberland, Old Burnside looting, but there is a flooded town, which you see that in stories about the South, that these towns were flooded to create lakes. And there certainly is one at the bottom of Lake Cumberland, apparently. Kind of secondary to that, Andrea said there are bottom-dwelling fish as well as large carp in the lake. They're not aggressive, but they would eat a person if you swam in front of them. I'm not sure if she means the fish or the cars.
The fish or the cars.
Yeah, exactly. she says she doubts the giant fish thing is true. I think Andrea maybe need to, the truth is out there. Maybe need to buy in on this. But of course, these are the rumors that go around. There's also like a waterfall not far from Lake Cumberland called Cumberland Falls. It's a beautiful waterfall in the state of Kentucky. And Andrea says if you go at night on a full moon, you can witness a moon bow. And it's one of the only places in the state for sure, and maybe some of limited places in the world where you can see a moon bow. Haley, can you see a moon bow around Niagara Falls? Do you know?
I don't. What? Tell me more about this moon bow. Like it just
that's fake news. All you need to see a moon, just like a sun. There's not limitations on where you can see moon bows. It's just a moon. It's like a rainbow that you would see at night due to the light of the moon and the precipitation.
I've never seen one at the falls. No.
Have you ever seen one at all?
I don't think so.
Kurt, do you see a lot of moonbows in Chicago or Michigan?
Well, back in Michigan, you would see them occasionally. Obviously, the city lights here in Chicago kind of make it hard to see anything like that at night. But in Michigan, definitely.
Well, Kurt, don't worry. Someday you'll find it, the moonbow connection.
Your mic, you don't want to be more Muppety, I don't think.
I know, exactly.
turn away from
I'm,
this.
I'm already inviting comparisons. Now I'm just steering into the curve at this point.
Steering into the Kermit, maybe. one final thing about Lake Cumberland. My uncle bought a isolated cabin down there that was like adjacent to the water, but it was impossible to get to. It was like 45 minutes from the highway and just through these windy country roads. And we thought, man, this place is so out of the way and in the middle of nowhere. Like you feel really isolated. And I swear to you, like not long after he bought it, the Kentucky State Police found a body that he serial killer had dumped about maybe like 2/10 of a mile from the front of his driveway. So it's like, this is exactly that kind of place. Like there are a lot of weird out of the way places down at Lake Cumberland. And I have at least one story I can't tell on the podcast about things I've witnessed down there. My cousin used to play guitar at that same marina, Lee's Ford. And he got into some like justified TV show level backwoods like dark crime stories by just playing guitar there and getting involved with the wrong people. So fun times at Lake Cumberland for sure, be it from being eaten by a giant car, seeing a moon bow, which Kurt has no love for, or swimming and looting Old Burnside. Lots of things to do there.
Yeah, I'm surprised that a Boyd Crowder and the Klan did not show up to attend these parties.
I mean, they maybe did. That's, I think, part of it. So we didn't really necessarily see it on the edit, but maybe there's a reason we didn't see it. But anyway, thanks to Andrea for those Lake Cumberland tips. I guess hopefully if there's more places we go to in Kentucky instead of other states, which we'll talk about, we can get more stories like that for sure.
Yeah, already putting in calls for a Nashville expert for next week. So the chefs show up to Lake Cumberland without a body in tow, and they are greeted by some Bravo royalty. Captain Sandy, a below deck Mediterranean, and Captain Lee, a below deck OG, I suppose. I admit I do not watch Below Deck. I am not of the nautical variety or the nautical dramatic variety. Though I will say, Haley, if they are saying, hey, we're giving you these boats to use, maybe not the best advertising for these boats, considering what happens in this episode.
Yeah, I feel like this crossover for another Bravo show, Below Deck, was not one that would made me be like, you know what, I am going to check out Below Deck.
Yeah, it's true. Though I don't know. Kurt, I know that there's been a lot of tinfoil hat things going on as to planned twists that may or not be going on in reality shows. Do you think there's a chance that Captain Sandy and Captain Lee decided to funk a bit with the mechanisms within the boats to cause some extra drama with the show and put the chefs at their wits' end?
I doubt it, given that unless they like sabotaged each other's boats. Although I have not watched Below Deck, I have watched various random other one-off Bravo. There's a special term for like the workplace reality show genre in terms of like I can't remember what it is, but there was one that took place in a ski resort in Canada that lasted one season that was a complete and utter train wreck. And now they think about it and kind of what kind of pool of shows that could potentially dip into. I think that would be a very a train wrecky season of like, you know, Top Chef cross promotion season. But I don't think they have to go there yet, thankfully.
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't think we've really had a lot of Bravo crossover. More so we've had like episodes last week with Lena Waithe where it's more so like rando celebrity than it is like, oh my God, Lisa Vanderpump's here. Well, I guess you're hosting this quickfire.
That's when they go completely a web-only version of Top Chef would be the crossover season. Top Chef OTT.
Exactly. LCK with VPR. I'm here for it. So, as we talked about, the chefs are starting to get to work when, in true Murphy's Law fashion for the poor blue team, right when they're about to prep everything, the power blows. The generator on the boat blows. With 14 and a half hours before service, this becomes the main crux of the drama. Antonio, we obviously know that this team loses. Ultimately, did you feel like at this point that this was sort of them signing their death warrant, considering now the even more arduous circumstances they're up against?
It actually, I think it was overblown, not just like the generator overblown. It seemed like it only lasted for a few hours. It was at night. It was something that didn't really seemingly detract too much from their prep. I don't know how they had some like a jury-rigged cable situation going on there where they were able to plug in induction burners, even though they didn't have power. I know that it being hot would have been a concern, but again, it was really after the sun went down and it seemed like it was only out for a few hours. I don't think this really affected what they were doing other than morale. I think it hurt morale for sure.
Yeah.
But I think other than that, I mean, David at the end of the challenge says like it had no real effect on what we were doing. We all did the dishes we wanted to do. It didn't affect our prep. I think morale though, it did probably not help. They just looked miserable and maybe it's because they were cooking in the dark or they were tired or Adrian was sick or Davey looked like he just wanted to die. But it was rough. Like I just don't know if the morale was helped at all.
And even Kelsey like came over and was like, you guys, we're not using our stove. For some reason, we're not using our stove on our ship. And you're welcome to come over and use that if you wish to. So I mean, they had, and then you have, you know, Eddie and team MacGyvering up, you know, burners to, get things heated and boiling in non-traditional situations. So I think the fact that, David steps forth and says at the end, like you pointed out, Antonio, that it really, we want to make clear that we're not here because of the power situation. and nobody seemed to, you know, you can contest that. So I think, yeah, you're right. I think that the biggest hit was potentially morale, and maybe that's not something that was obvious at the time. But I don't think it impacted their cooking.
I think that the most vocal person about how difficult this situation is was poor Brian. And look, I don't want to call this episode a mercy killing, but it kind of was. I don't know. The edit, in my opinion, did not really paint Brian in a good light throughout this episode, to the point of where David says, you know, hey, as long as we're working, things are getting done. And he just muses like, well, that's a very asinine philosophy. Haley, what were your thoughts about the way Brian was portrayed in this episode?
It was very rough. Like, it was just... I watched the episode after I knew he went home. So just some of the things I picked up on, like him being like, oh, I'm going to stay up all night. We're going to stay up all night and we're going to work through it. It doesn't matter if I'm tired tomorrow. And then him getting into the hot tub in a hot day. And it was funny, but then he was, you know, regretting his decision for hours and hours. And, you know, during judges table when he was like, I can't believe nobody stood up for me to say that I was up all night. It was just, there was a couple
that
little
was a
moments
weird part.
Where it was just like, oh, okay. And like, I still felt like Brian was, you know, like typical Brian in this episode. And I think Brian's just such a fun personality for this show. So I still enjoyed him this episode. But you're right. His editing was just like a scooch odd.
Yeah. Kurt, you agree with Haley there?
Yeah, though it wasn't necessarily that. The only really weird thing for me, I did pick up on little things like the that's an odd added when Dave says as long as we're working, right? The weirdest thing for me, which came out of left field in terms of like strange edit, was that that post discussion while the judges were deliberating, where he expresses surprise that nobody stood up for him for staying up all night, when the show kind of positioned it as a decision and not a sacrifice, I guess.
Seem like everyone else had to do that. And we saw the green team, and I was worried that it was going to be a bit of a what happened to them in Restaurant Wars, where it was like, oh, they were napping, so everything's going to go to shit. Where, you know, they took the time to go to sleep and were able to have fun. And you're right. It was a decision on Brian's part and not a necessity.
And it didn't really go anywhere. Like, it wasn't like it sparked a huge debate. I think it was even Michelle who said, well, that wasn't, you know, that it really didn't contribute to anything. Like, I don't know. It was just a strange moment. And to your point about like the other team, I had thought that we were going to see a story play out where the entire team of four, you know, we're all just going to take a nap. We all just meant to take a nap for 45, 60 minutes or what have you. And it was going to be like, oh, suddenly the morning's here and all four of us had slept in. But that's more of a, like, if this was a fictional narrative, that would be the sort of thing that would potentially happen.
I thought that was going to happen too.
Oh my God. Could you imagine like them, like Kelsey's hair is out of whack. Like Justin's just in like a beater and shorts, just like having to serve his dish. Like they're all just so disheveled.
Well, it would have matched with their theme, though. I think they could have pulled it off.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe if the generators had turned off on there as well, all their alarm clocks would have gotten turned off. Yeah, I mean, and when Brian says later, I mean, I feel like Brian feels like this was not his challenge. Like he says later on, before that little tantrum that he throws to your point, Kurt, was he's like, I feel like fun was a stupid thing to care about. And it's like, I mean, maybe, but like,
so good.
It's also like the most Squidward thing I've heard in quite some time.
That's like my philosophy, exactly 50% of my time. And then like the complete opposite, the other 50%.
But like, I thought the benefit of this challenge was it really could have been anyone's challenge. You just have to like go for it. Like it was, like you guys said before, it's not like it was an incredibly difficult challenge technically. And like, sure, the power went out and it was hot that day, but other than that, it didn't seem like it was that intense or high pressure or anything. I don't know.
I think the most pressurized point of this was, like, other than the power going out on, well, technically both boats at different times, was the fact that we have to cook, you know, 100, it seemed like we have to cook 100, prepare 100 dishes in this small kitchen. That seemed to be the only real sticking point that was brought up as the main stressor.
Yeah, and the other little stressor is the fact that, as we mentioned before, Adrian ends up sort of having to check herself out of the preparatory period, just not feeling well. I don't think we got a follow-up on her conditions. She does say she's recovering by the end, so it doesn't feel like this is going to be, you know, a long-term storyline like it might be with someone like Sheldon slipping and hurting his back, as an example, in season 14. But, Antonio, when it comes back to, I guess, you know, playing the blame game of it all, were you surprised that there was not more consternation sent Adrian's way for not being there the day of to serve up her dish?
I wasn't super surprised. I got to give a shout out to Vince Mancini at Up Rocks, who consistently writes hilarious Top Chef chef rankings and episode recaps, essentially. And he keeps referring to Adrian as having hollow bones like a bird.
Oh, my God.
Like Phoebe from 30 Rock.
Yes, like or 30 Rock, exactly. So this is he has been saying that all season, and I'm like, wow, that's a. But I mean, this maybe is part of that. I don't know. She was getting sick before when they were on their way to the challenge, so she clearly caught a bug of some sort, and that is. I don't think her team held any of that against her. Eddie is such a team player. We saw him really step up for Brian in Restaurant Wars and do a great job with the prep of Brian's dish. Brian ultimately wins. We see Eddie doing much the same here, stepping up for Adrian. If anything, I wonder if Adrian being out of the challenge and Eddie having to step up and do that for her helped keep Eddie safe. Because
I'm wondering that.
Yeah, it gave him something else to do, right? That makes sense, right?
Yeah, I've had it down to between Brian and Eddie as most likely going home. Like, they didn't, like, other than Adrian not being there to actually serve her dish, it seemed like they actually potentially liked her dish the best of the five, or if not in the top two. And I don't think that, and I think that, you know, she probably got it, you know, 90 to 95% of the way there. So I was pretty sure she was going to be safe. But when it came down to discussion of the actual dishes, I know we're jumping ahead to judges table, but I had in my mind, like, it's probably down to Brian and Eddie between these two. And I do wonder, like you, Antonio, did the fact that Eddie contributed to more than one dish, did that help him potentially kind of like make the case for him to stay?
It's crazy because if not for what happened in episode two of the season with the Whole Foods shopping and the lamb, I think we would be talking about how Eddie was one of the most significant team players in Top Chef history. Clearly, he has a huge hurdle to clear after that episode, but we've seen him just do this repeatedly, and he takes this stuff on without real complaint, and there's nothing in the edit to suggest that he has any real problem with that at all. So I think that did not really seem to hurt their team. I really think the underreported part of, as you like to talk about underreported, Kurt, I think the underreported part of why Blue Team loses is not having Sarah. And I think that represents, that reflects in the choices that are made with not making Jiggle Juice or not having the fun of a party.
The Jiggle Juice didn't go over that well, apparently.
Well,
but it was like a touch. It was just like a thing that really heightened the party element.
True. It was
and we don't know how well it went over with the partygoers. Padma didn't. Padma made like a cat, hairball face. But
she's so out of touch. I can't tell you how many Jello shots I've consumed in the past 10 years. I would be all over that Jiggle Juice.
She also ate it.
Yeah.
I think she's shooting it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like how in the kind of just the off the cuff discussion of it, it's a Jello shot, but in the confessionals, like, you're gonna have to call this a gelatin shot, please.
Yeah, it's like the Kleenex tissue thing. I guess Jello really has a mark close there.
As somebody who works on for the company that produces I believe we'll have to refer to it as facial tissue.
Oh boy. Well, I just think Sarah being there also helped. There was a lot of Paducah pride, I think.
Yeah.
And I think she was
that's a good point.
The troops to say, like, I'm a hometown, vote for me. You know, I think that's the big reason why the green team loses. I think if Eddie picks Sarah, I think we could actually have seen a flip flop. Because if I'm not wrong, right, they said the food was there were at least one party goer who said the blue team's food was better. So I think it was not having Sarah that really tipped the scales there.
I don't know. I think Kelsey was another big indicator
as well. For sure.
Because, I mean, Kelsey, I think she's another surprising choice who Eddie did not pick because, I mean, she's a caterer really by her in her day to day. And this is essentially what she does is arranging meals off-site, not exactly in a kitchen. And I think she was a great job as well in terms of like really laying out what needs to get done, especially, you know, the reason why they didn't need to use the ovens is because she was able to help arrange this menu that right. was not so prep intensive, that they could, you know, make this these small but tasty things that didn't necessarily have to rely on all this cookery in order to pull it off, especially for 100 guests and especially in a rowdy atmosphere, so they could focus on creating said atmosphere. I think that those Kelsey and Sarah were by far the two MVPs of this episode.
And the fact that, I mean, she even talks to the, you know, as a, you know, on-site caterer, she's used to having a not necessarily a plan B, but like when the mechanism you need to get plan A implemented goes awry, there's another, she always has like, here's the backup to make sure that plan A still works. So I think that having to kind of work on the fly is something that, like, I'm surprised that Eddie didn't pick, Sarah for both the familiarity and the hometown advantage. And then the fact that, you know, that he and Adrian and Justin were in the top three for both the quick fire and the elimination challenge last week. I would have picked both Justin and Adrian. And then you also bring in Kelsey for her party planning experience, which she's talked to before. Now, does that go to, I do think that Eddie just kind of was deer in the headlights moment. I'm picking, who do I see? Adrian, Brian, chair, wall. These are my teammates. But
I love lamp.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that he was going for who can I beat, but if he had, like, my dream team would have been Eddie, Adrian, Justin, Sarah, and Kelsey at the same time. That's a dangerous team to pick if something goes wrong and you're in the bottom, bottom group.
I mean, look, he lost and he wanted to be like that guy from Titanic and throw himself into the propellers anyway. So I feel like Eddie was ready for the worst.
Yeah, I think he's perpetually ready for the worst. I think Eddie is, you know, prepare for the worst, hope for the best.
Yeah, he's ready, Eddie. He's consistently just prepared for the worst case scenario, including, again, when the generators turn off, he actually does a really nice job of stepping up and figuring out all these solutions, which even, you know, Debbie Downer Brian will commend him for. Let's move into these parties. Do you guys want to start with the good or the not so good?
Not so good. Not so good.
All right. Well, let's start with the not so good. Let's move over to the blue team here. First, Haley, can you talk to me about the choice that Brian makes, the fun choice sleep deprived Brian makes that nobody can talk him off the ledge with, which is, let me get into a hot tub fully clothed in the middle of summer and serve my porchetta?
I truly cannot, because I get nauseated when I get a little too warm. So having to stand in a hot tub and in the sun, I think I would have definitely thrown up at some point. The visual of this huge man standing in a hot tub with his shoes on was hilarious to me, but it doesn't mean I comprehend what was going on at all.
Antonio, can you find a method to this man's madness here?
No, it's just madness. Part of the reason I've liked Brian the whole time is he's just a big goofball, and he thought it was funny. I hope that the heater on that hot tub wasn't on. Water baking in the hot sun is more than enough. So hopefully they did get some ice for him in that tub. His hair and just forehead did not reflect that might have been the case. I want to talk about a lot of sweat in this episode. We'll talk about it more at Judge's table. But Brian was drenched in sweat, and not the best call. But Haley, did you say that you and Brian have the same wardrobe choices? Is that
we
what I saw?
Do.
You
do. He was wearing this really great Canadian tuxedo. Like every it hit me this episode. Every outfit Brian has, like I also.
So I've thought the Canadian tux was all denim, like a denim jacket with denim jeans. Okay, so I didn't see that. I guess I missed that.
He was wearing like a darker pair of denim jeans and like a denim shirt rather than like a denim jacket over a t-shirt. Yeah.
Why? That's a horrible choice to make in the middle of the summer.
Well, it wasn't like outside. He wasn't wearing that. I think he was wearing that in the boat. You know what? That doesn't make it any better. You're right. It's a bad choice. For
sometimes fashion trumps comfort, Mike. Take it from me, Fashion Plate Clark.
Not your nickname in college.
Not my nickname.
I mean, I think, yeah, he's a man who rocks a pompadour. I think he does maybe prep style, which I think shows here with his porchetta, which he really wants to pull off, but apparently tastes like a slice of boar's head ham. According to the judges. Antonio, can you describe what exactly happened with the belly separating from the loin? I know Brian was trying to explain it, and I haven't gotten my questions back from him to figure out exactly how he vocalized it. But to your understanding, what exactly happened here with Brian's dish that ultimately ends up finally sending him home?
Well, the porchetta is a roast, and it's a roast that's tied the way it's tied. And I think you're supposed to get a crispy skin on the outside. And it sounded to me like he said he tied it perfectly. And he was in trying to get the prep that he wanted. It did not ultimately play out the way he wanted it to. So there was some separation in the roast. It did not come out like he wanted it to come out. Like if you were to look at what a porchetta is supposed to look like as a roll versus maybe just like a center eye, there was a debate going on there whether his matched what the expectation was versus the reality. I did not understand his explanation. Fully did not understand what he says went wrong. But you could see that it did not look exactly like maybe he probably wanted it to look.
And it's also just a really odd choice for a boat party food.
Yeah, I think they went with a tiki theme, and so the flavors sounded good to me. There were
but make it a slider. Make it something like bite size. Like I don't, if I'm at a boat party, I don't want to have to try and find a hard surface so I can use a fork and knife to eat something.
It's a good point.
Might I suggest the edge of the hot tub? There's plenty of room.
and like once again, underreported is how much they enjoyed the cold, chilled shrimp. That was being, I think it was the shrimp that Kelsey was serving. Am I correct on that?
The oyster.
Oyster, yeah. That's right. Sorry. So,
I think Justin's shrimp as well. The cold shrimp was what they really enjoyed.
So, yeah. So I think not only, it's like several things. It's A, the fun atmosphere. B, the fact that it's kind of like, you know, they referred to Eddie's bite as being ideal and like for a fun cocktail party, but the fact that they thought, cocktail party was kind of a miss there. So, but you still, the bite sizeness is key. And then three, the fact that you're out in the heat, you want something kind of chilled, cool, and refreshing. So like large chunks of pork loin that are hot really kind of, I think for me,
served from a hot tub.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that was kind of like the conceptualization of like, even if the dishes were cooked perfectly, I think there was some just conceptualization issues in terms of hot food, not bite size, not fun and casual. I think
I just realized that Brian literally made hot ham water, and I'm here for it.
And a smack of ham.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. To compliment Michelle's salsa water. I mean, and this is also like Brian. I think he needs to stop trying to make brining happen. Like,
oh gosh, I saw that.
Yeah, all the way back in the first episode when he's like, "Oh, I brined, you know, this dish," and Pam is like, "I'm not really a big fan of brine," and as a result, he decides to brine his pork here. And as a result, that's what makes it really taste like ham. And it sort of unfortunately breaks one of those Top Chef cardinal rules of if you put a dish out there and you call it something that it's not, that's going to ding you heavily. And I have to imagine, Antonio, that's one big reason why they knocked this dish ultimately.
Oh, definitely. And it seems like brining is really the third rail right now. I mean, I experience it most with chicken, buttermilk brine chicken, or if you're brining a roast chicken, I'm all in on that. And maybe I'm on the outside, or maybe that's not considered by the Top Chef judges right now to be a good idea. But you're right, Mike, that is something that has come up a lot this season. And it's something that Brian is forcing, Brian, and Tom does not have, he's not having it. Like that may, more than anything, that may be why he goes home.
I think we saw just after like the first two consecutive episodes, we as the host of the podcast saw very quickly, okay, brining should not be a thing this season. It was kind of like, I think there was brining that went on a couple times early on. And it was like very clear, like that was going to be a no-no. So kind of steer clear of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to your point, Kurt, maybe the other dish that really did not land well. Let's talk about Eddie's shrimp and prosciutto lollipop, because as he shrugs and puts it, like people like things on sticks. Haley, what do you think about Nilou's comment that essentially he was trying to fantasize something that she does at a cocktail party on the reg?
Yeah, like, do I want shrimp wrapped in prosciutto? Absolutely. Those are two of my favorite things. Is it something that I, Haley Strong, terrible at everything, can make? Yes. Eddie, come on. Shoot for above Haley Strong level food.
It's a good rule to go by, I suppose. I mean, I think the issue was, I mean, there was a bit of a conceptual issue according to Nilou. I think the judges had more problems with the fact that it wasn't grilled to order. I think to your point, Haley, it seemed like Eddie almost considered his own dish an afterthought, as weird as that is. Maybe it's because he was trying to concentrate on so much and he was thinking about this idea of party food, but he essentially just pre-made a bunch of shrimp and prosciutto on skewers and didn't really give it a lot of attention to really, you know, give some flair to it that might have elevated it above the strong line, as it were.
Oh, no, now that's a thing.
You made it a thing, Haley.
You're right, I did. It's my fault. Yeah, what Eddie did was probably not the best idea, but I think he was just trying to keep the boat above water, as you will. And also, I just want to say I am a little surprised Adrian didn't get dinged for not being there during service, because in my Top Chef rewatch, I was watching season 11 this week, and in one of the challenges, Nick was sick, and Padma was like, well, if he's not here, then he gets sent home immediately. Like, sorry. And I guess Adrian did have, like, a component in the party, but it was like, she thought of the idea, and then it went to Eddie, and Eddie did everything else. That's just my opinion on it. You know, just, you know, for whatever it's worth.
By the same token, though, she wasn't technically at judge's table, so she couldn't go home.
Great point, Kurt.
Yeah, she didn't get sent literally below deck by the judges.
Yeah, I thought that was going to potentially be like, exit, stage left. Like,
yeah, exactly. Adrian, please go down to the galley. And then they say, chefs, Adrian is not coming back. we put her on a boat and she's off.
She's been sent to a farm.
She's been sent to the farm that Mr. Carney was talking so highly about last time.
And I know we're kind of like jumping all over on this episode, which is, I think it's fine.
Are you getting seasick, Kurt?
Yeah, a little bit. Just hang tight, focus on a point on the horizon and continue talking. And this was weird because then there was like that post pack your knives moment where they all get called back to the deck of judges table. And I thought there was going to be some sort of announcement like, you know, Adrian's ill, or it was a strange way to wrap up the show in terms of like using the end of the show to preview where they're going next. Did anybody else kind of get that feeling that it was like an odd?
It was very odd. That seems like a next time on clip.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I thought there was going to be some special announcement of, Adrian isn't feeling well and had to leave the show or something like that. But then she was there, and it was simply just, we're, you know, heading off to, you know, Music City or whatever. Somewhere not in Kentucky.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely talk about that. Going back to the dishes for a hot second, and speaking of hot, Antonio, what do you think was going through David's head that led to the conceiving of this dish? Because as many points as we made about Brian's issues with the heat, it feels like David was actually falling for a very similar folly. And I think Nilu just had an amazing point of like, dude, if you want to go for this dumpling with a spiced coconut broth, just put it in a pot sticker. Not only is that a better temperature, but it also just, it goes more along the lines of like not necessarily a canapé, but like a finger food that is more appropriate for a party like setting.
I was a little over Nilu's judging, to be honest, of this particular dish, only because she said to him, like, oh, maybe it could have been just a pot sticker. And then at the table, at judge's table, she says, basically, my own idea was genius. It should have been a pot sticker. It's like, you came up with the idea. He never said that it was something he had contemplated.
If only he had listened to me after the fact.
Yes, exactly. So I'm a little down on that, because I don't know. This is the thing. This episode to me was a bit of a letdown across the board. I agree with Haley that it was a fun episode, and I enjoyed like the milieu, like all the things about the episode that made it fun. I didn't think that the judges' table comments necessarily reflected what we were getting at the party. I understand that the, hey, it could have been a pot sticker was a comment that was made at the time, but when they were eating it, I didn't sense there was a lot of negative feedback about the dish. And I certainly didn't sense all the negative feedback about these dishes from the people that were going to the party. So I don't know. I think we're nitpicking a little bit with David. I don't think his dish was that bad. I didn't think when they were eating it that it was that bad. I felt like it was something that was okay. And it was fine. I didn't really think there were major problems with this. And I think the idea that there might've been a problem with this wasn't really reflected in the episode at all. I don't know. I just, I just don't know that we got a little bit of negative feedback, but not much. I just thought this was a fine dish. I don't think there was a major flaw in conception or delivery. David hasn't been doing so well in the competition since he was doing great at the beginning. So I think he's in his own head a little bit. And I think maybe he is one of these people who is in the position where they were just cooking great, amazing, like umami bomb food at the beginning of the competition. And now maybe needs to get back to cooking his food. And so maybe that was reflected in his choices here. But I honestly didn't think his was that bad on this team. I think the feedback on the negative feedback on the blue team overall was really for the purpose of the episode, because it seemed pretty clear that Brian should go home.
Do we have, Haley, any thoughts about the other two dishes? Because to Antonio's point, I do feel like Brian and Eddie earned the majority of the negative feedback, with a couple of Nilu sprinkled in comments about the pot sticker of it all. But it feels like Adrienne got positive comments for her taco bar. Michelle got some mixed comments about her potato chip crusted Kentucky bass with an onion dip sauce and dip sauce in honor of her mom making onion dip for literally every occasion. Where I think Tom didn't like it because it wasn't hot, but Emerald, Mr. Rings of Gold himself, showing off his luscious locks.
That's all I could look at when he walked in.
I know. Basically, it's like a Garnier Fructis commercial in the middle of Top Chef. But Haley, did you have any thoughts about either Michelle or Adrian's dish before we hop over to the fun side of things?
I will say that every single dish on this episode was something I would want to eat, especially the grilled salmon tacos. Those looked and sounded delicious. And I love a good fish and chips. You know what? I'm fine with my food not being super hot. Like, I prefer it, like, you know, slightly warm. So I feel like the Michelle's fish would have been, like, perfect for me.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, any thoughts about those two?
I would have... See, I'm not the biggest fish fan, and I'm referring to, well, technically both the band and
they
the
jam real hard, Kurt.
Yeah. I like jam. I just don't like jam bands. And so I like the idea of the taco bar. I mean, with the taco, at least there's enough I can put on there that you're getting flavor along with the salmon. I would have liked the Michelle's dish if it was just the potato chips and onion dip. But again, that's just more I'm never going to choose fish off of a menu when there's the seafood dumpling scallops and this porchetta. Like, there's other things I would have wanted to try. But I wouldn't have, like, turned away and not tried any of it. So it just isn't the sort of thing that turns me on.
All right, let's move over to the other boat here. Let's start with Kelsey's ultimate winning dishes. Antonio, my notes are smudged. What seafood did Kelsey make? Remind me.
Oh, you're really setting me up here, Mike. Kelsey made oysters. Yeah. I feel bad. She got to say oyster a lot in this episode, so I know that I'm not the only one who's noticed it at this point. Yeah, she made oysters. She made them in a dishwasher? No, she cleaned the shells in a dishwasher, which was a genius move. And she just made what sounded like a great Alabama oyster, and she did it in such a way that really represented her state and herself well. And then she made the puppy food, so she crushed it for sure in this challenge. And like you were saying earlier, just picking her also brings the smartness of knowing how to plan a party like this. So she was definitely the MVP, definitely made the winning dishes. I thought the episode from the jump really starts reflecting this. And yeah, oysters all around.
Haley, what did you think about what Kelsey ended up putting out here?
This episode is like, yes, this is why I love Kelsey so much. She was so excited to party plan. She like went to town. She had a great time doing it. She made two great dishes. I think making a take-home bag is just a genius idea. The fact that Green Team made that take-home bag and they made a cocktail, whether or not it was a successful cocktail, like, I think that really adds to the party atmosphere. And I think that's something that Sarah and Kelsey did so well. They brought the party atmosphere. Everything they served sounds just delicious. And the four of them together, like, let me watch that reality show.
Yeah, like, I definitely enjoy some of the personalities on their team, but I'll admit I was rooting for the Green Team mainly because I would honestly like to hang out with them more. They just seem like a more fun group of people. Kurt, have you remade the Key Lime Crunch Puppy Chow in honor of this podcast?
The honoring each episode with my own take on one of their dishes lasted a whole 2 weeks, but I blame the holidays and my travel. I was thinking, like, if I had made it, I was actually thinking when I watched this on Thursday evening, if I was to make something from this episode, it probably would have been like, let me try this jiggle juice. This sounds like I could actually just throw some things and let it set. And but in terms of the puppy chow, was a close second. I've had like the more kind of just chocolate and peanut butter version with the rice chex. I've not quite had the key lime and coconut take on it. And I do like oysters. And I do think that, you know, also Kelsey's contribution to, I think she helped out with Sarah's dish in terms of when they were shopping at Whole Foods and Sarah found out that there wasn't lobster. So Kelsey was the one that piped up and said, well, just do a shrimp roll instead. And then also, you know, the fact that her and Justin basically used the whole watermelon. They didn't let any part of the watermelon go to waste.
Team watermelon.
I think it was just like, again, I really liked her philosophy in approaching this challenge in terms of having to be adaptable and always thinking about, kind of like Jim said, having like a plan B, knowing because plan A can always get derailed. And she didn't really have to dip into her plan B too much here. So thumbs up on Kelsey.
Wait, Kurt, who made hollandaise? You said because of the hollandaise, you got sidetracked on this? I don't know
how to toss that ball back to you, Antonio.
now we have to wait until next season. Keep that pun in your pocket, Antonio, for happy hollandaise.
I will say, shout out to Chef Kelsey at Kelsey Barnard Clark on Instagram. I understand because I want to make this puppy chow. I did some research. I think she's going to be doing an Instagram live where she goes through this. She apparently has periodically been doing these. So if you're interested in that recipe, follow her on Instagram and look for her stories because she will apparently be going over how to make that. It sounded really good to me. The idea of banana, key lime, salty, sweet, it just sounded really good. So I'm looking forward to learning how to make that at home. I instantly wanted to as soon as I saw it.
Ironically enough, I think she did tropical better than the Tiki team. Just because I agree with you, Kurt, that I think I'm more used to the like chocolate and peanut butter of it all, but the key lime and coconut and banana is a combination I didn't really expect. So the fact that she was able to outdo the theming of the other team just speaks towards how great this episode was for her. And the oysters, I think, were so well done in that they were super simple. She talks about how, you know, she's hewing close to her Alabama spirit with it just being cocktail sauce, hot sauce, and lemon juice, but even adding small things like the horseradish and especially the pickled watermelon rind, I think just sort of increases the already complicated flavor profile of it to make it really, oddly enough, stand out for being that simplistic. So I'm really happy for Kelsey. I think she's been doing very well in the competition so far. You know, she's been in the top a couple times, and this is the first time that she's finally won something. I think it continues the tradition of just really there being no front runner, just scattershot wins across the board. But let's move on to talk about maybe someone else who is definitely up there. You mentioned Sarah beforehand with her shrimp roll and the jiggle juice. Haley, did you have any additional thoughts about what Sarah ended up putting out here?
Yes, I do. Let me look at it. Oh my God. A shrimp roll sounds amazing. Do you want more? it sounds amazing.
Do you need me to expand on that? Because I got nothing.
Sorry, I don't do Antonio level soliloquies about like food dishes. I just go, yeah, I would.
Yeah, it's just like, but usually I'll see something nice on Instagram and I'll just type want, and then that pretty much sums up like my feelings about the shrimp roll.
Yeah,
I thought the choice of brioche was super interesting. I just don't necessarily think about like shrimp pairing with brioche, but I guess it ended up working out, especially with the Meyer
lemon zest.
Everything
pairs with brioche. Let's just start there.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Antonio, you feeling good about your Kentucky girl? She's had a couple of times in the bottom of the past few episodes. Do you think this is a good straighten up back to a position she should be in moving forward?
Yeah, and I agree with Haley that everything pairs with brioche. I think that you talk about a fatty thing or like a shrimp. I think that normally what you when you got a fatty lobster, you want something like that with a fatty. I mean, it just it pairs really well. So good for her. Good for Sarah. She talked about how her parties usually end with her taking her shirt off and running around. We saw maybe like the first chapter of that when she's having the jiggle juice the night before and she puts on a floaty and ends up on the floor.
I just loved that little like scene of them just like partying and like all over the floor. Like it was just magical Top Chef that I want.
And that's when Kurt goes to the other boat. Can I come over here?
but then they end the second day with like all going into the water and poor Eric. I mean, I have a fear of open water, so I would totally be like Eric, like clinging to a floaty with a life vest around my neck. But
the concept or the movie?
Would you be surprised if one actually inspired the other? Because it's not too far from the truth. It's so interesting that they showed that. And I don't know if the blue team ever got in the water. Granted, Brian was basically in the water for the entire service. But it did seem interesting that, again, the edit pointed to them doing all these fun things while the blue team is just sort of like work, work, work. Let's, I guess, touch upon the other two dishes here between Justin's watermelon salad with tequila marinated shrimp and basil croutons with vinaigrette. They basically talk about how this is just a great appropriate dish for the setting. I do feel like what Justin does really well is it's weird to say he cooks appropriate food, but I feel like between this episode and the last one, he's one of the most keen eyes to know what a challenge calls for, and he's going to cook food to represent that, and it's worked out for him so far, and hopefully it does moving forward.
And I say it's not just what does Lake Cumberland party boat food like, but it's almost like Justin plus Lake Cumberland equals what? So it's contextually relevant food, but representative of him. So I think that's what he's good at.
Antonio, can you describe a bit the difficulties that Eric experienced with frying his fish, even though to the judge's point, it ends up not really affecting the final product?
Not only does it not affect the final product, but I think he actually gets credit for what he ends up having to do. Because if you remember what Tom says about Michelle's dish, he's like, it was a little cold. And you think maybe, well, you got to make fish at a party like this, but his was hot. And it's like, well, his was hot because he was doing it like a la minute, like he was doing it for each particular person that he was making, running up and down the stairs, frying them downstairs. So it seemed like it actually ended up helping him rather than hurting him because of the ding on Michelle. So it seemed like maybe his fryer was shorting out when it got to a certain temperature. Maybe it didn't have enough juice or something. I don't know. But
never good with a fryer.
Right, yeah, because you're going to have it be hot. But it was odd that he cited a very specific, like, when it gets to 160, it's gone. It's like, well, I don't know if there's not enough power there, if there's an issue with the fryer itself. But he made it work. He pivoted. Sarah vamped for him. And it ended up, I think, helping him because his dishes came out piping hot, and the judges really liked that.
Mm-hmm. So let's move into the final results here, as we pointed out before, of the out of the 100 votes, 99, if you're not including Kurt's indecisiveness and ping-ponging between two boats, with nearly 80%, the green team wins. They enjoyed the party setting more. Kelsey ends up winning for her unique take. Moving over to the blue team, it is finally time for Brian to go. Let's eulogize Brian here a little bit, not to talk too much about Last Chance Kitchen, because it's been a bit of a rough go for Brian, which is strange considering the fact that he did win, restaurant wars between his front of house service that really excelled compared to the other two, in addition to his taking a risk in the Ballantine and really pulling it off. But outside of that, he finished in the bottom in 4 out of the last 5 challenges. Haley, do you think this was just a case of he was in a slump that he just couldn't pull himself out of?
Yeah, and a lot of the times it seemed like he was overthinking everything he was doing. He just wasn't being himself almost, and it just wasn't working out for him. And I'm so sad that he's not on the main show anymore, because I really love Brian. Like, he's so funny. He's such an interesting character. So I'm really sad about him.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, what did you have to think about Brian, specifically the way that he ended his run on Top Chef, the OG show?
I mean, I'm sure that, you know, the team will probably talk about it next week. Like, next week would have been the Restaurant Wars Challenge. And so in this case, we have a situation where it kind of surprises me that in a standard season, we're talking about a situation where Brian would not have seen Restaurant Wars. And I'm kind of getting a Tyler vibe from last season with with Brian in terms of somebody who was kind of confessional gold, but gone much earlier than I thought that they would be. But at the same time, like you said, he was in the bottom for, you know, several of the last challenges. I would not be surprised if we see in some sort of returnee form of all the people who have left so far. I think along with Nini, I potentially see Brian as a returnee contender.
I would love to just see this season played out again.
Again.
The exact same people without the vets going in Last Chance Kitchen. Just to see what would happen. Like, same challenges, same restaurant wars. Just to, like, see. Like, let's just do that again. Let's just play the season out.
Now, do these contestants have any knowledge that they played before? Or are we, like, wiping their memory Men in Black style and just watching it play out?
No, I want them to be like, we all know each other. This is a thing. We all know we've already done this, but just play it again.
Antonio, Brian was on your team in the very beginning of the season with our draft. What do you have to say to send him off to sale here?
First of all, I feel terrible that Nashville Brian doesn't get to go to Nashville. That hurts my heart. It hurts my heart.
He whetted our appetite with the Nashville hot last episode.
Yeah, it just makes me so sad that he doesn't. That would have been a career moment for him and something that would have been really fun. And it would have, I think, made him energized him maybe. And that could have been something that could have helped pull him out of his slump. But I will miss Brian. Like Haley, I echo the comments that she made. And what I liked about Brian initially really proved to be true. Like, and I think Tyler is a great comp, Kurt. I think that there's this like funny sense of humor, self-deprecation, interesting character. I hope Brian is able to balance the fun and the work of what he's doing, because it seemed like he was so focused on the work a lot of the time. We hear about him on his days off. He goes and works as a butcher. I just hope he's able to balance the fun and the work, and that balance is something that is rewarding to him, and that his batteries get charged up. Because I think that's something we saw throughout this competition. The work he puts in Restaurant Wars rewards him, but here the work he puts in does not reward him, and he feels let down that other people aren't stepping up and saying, but he worked the hardest. Sometimes it isn't all about work. Sometimes I think the fun has to really flow through, and he seems like such a fun, funny guy that I think it's there. So I just hope for him that that's something that he's able to balance more, because on the show it seemed like the edit maybe suggested that that was something he struggled with. So he goes out head held high, and I respect that for sure. Seemed like he had a good experience. And I know he's been doing events with Chef Justin, for example, and others from this season. So definitely looking forward to hearing more about what Brian does in the future.
I use the adage on the RuPaul's Drag Race podcast that just because you're a good drag queen doesn't necessarily make you a good Drag Race contestant automatically. I think that some of these shows test a certain set of skills that you might not encounter in your day-to-day. And I'm going to sort of ascribe the same thing to Brian here. I totally agree with you guys that I think he was very hilariously deadpan in confessionals. But I think his performance for the majority of these challenges just shows that I think he's very good at conceptualizing things. When it comes to this very pressurized situation that Top Chef provides of executing under such strenuous circumstances, it just doesn't work out for him. I don't know if necessarily this is the right type of competition for him. Because it does seem like, again, all the challenges where he finished in the bottom, whether it was him pickling the cocoa nibs in the dessert challenge, or flat top doing too much in the cocktail inspiration challenge, and frying all his gnocchi at once, or last time with just the poor way that he was unfortunately just completely five-holded when it came to his meat preparation. And I think it's just a matter of fact, sometimes the Top Chef competition is not the best for certain chefs. I do not think it reflects badly on their set of skills whatsoever. I think Brian showed with the ballotine, which is a reflection of an entire chef's education of skills, that he can absolutely do it. This just might not have been for him. Especially this challenge, considering how much he was not a big fan of the fun factor. But I do wish him the best of luck as he moves and as we move into Last Chance Kitchen. So, Kurt Clark, what challenge is Brian and unnamed competitor that will soon be revealed? So, spoiler alert, if you do not want to listen to that part, okay, you're gone now. Kurt, what's the Last Chance Kitchen challenge this week?
It is the Battle of the Bouffants. It is Brian versus Brandon, but
the Bouffants,
the Brofants. It is the Porky Challenge. So they, you know, kind of going off of the porchetta issues that Brian faced during the Elimination Challenge. Tom trots out the ears, trotters, skin, and tail of a pig. And they get, because, you know, working with some of these parts of the pig, and I'm sorry, Antonio, we've documented many times in the past your love of our friend the pig. So
yeah, this was rough.
I can imagine. These aren't the parts that Antonio likes, all the parts of a pig. They got an hour to work with these. I guess normally they get maybe like 20, 30 minutes, but I guess given that a lot of these, you need actually the time. They do extend the time, which also unfortunately gives Tom more time to make bad dad jokes over the course of the cooking. But yeah, they just like use these parts and do something tasty.
I can't recall how many pig parts I have put in my mouth over the course of my lifetime. Haley, what about you?
You know what? Jesus. I'm just going to have to submit my resignation to this podcast right now.
I think Antonio may be out too at this point.
Oh, boy. Well, do you have, and let me couch that in a less skeezy way.
Yeah, why don't we ask the only female member of the panel what pig part she's, no, I'm just kidding, Mike.
Because Antonio loves pigs, and Kurt just spoke, unfortunately. So, but have you ever had experience with eating these extraneous parts like pig ears or skin or tails or feet?
Yeah, I don't get real into the God. It makes me sound like, I don't know. Like, I don't do organs a lot. I don't do feet and stuff. When I was in China a couple of years ago, I think I had a bite of a pig foot, and it was I don't even remember. It was fine, I think. When I was in LA a couple of years ago, my friend Molly took me to this restaurant. I think it was called Petty Cash. It was a Mexican restaurant, and she had pig ear nachos, and those were pretty good. That I enjoyed. I would definitely eat pig ear again. But I don't get too wild with things usually.
I will say that I think my first exposure to this was actually pig ears are permanently affected for me because pig ears are a common snack for dogs.
Yeah,
so I can't imagine like eating a pig ear without thinking like, oh, I guess my dog and I now have a food we like in common. I have had some trotters, actually. I know that, I think Adrian talked
trotter,
about
Trotter, I hardly know her.
I think Adrian talked about this last season, about like how the scene in Harlem likes to use a lot of trotters in some of their food. And so I have had it a couple times. And I actually, you know, it depends on how it's prepared, but I actually do enjoy a trotter or two. The less you think about where it's coming from, the more you enjoy it. But I haven't admittedly not had skin or tail. Is something I'm really intrigued by, how you get meat out of that. Antonio, I don't know. Have you had any experience with any of these parts?
Not the tail. I mean, like you guys, the ears and feet. My mom, when I was younger, used to eat pickled pig's feet. Like, you'd buy them in a jar at the store. And I'm not hating on anybody who lives that kind of life. I personally, as I've said on this podcast, I'm struggling with my love of delicious pork, but also love of beautiful pigs. And every pig I've ever met, I've liked, which is a weird sentence to say. But this challenge was really rough for me to see it in that way. And I think the sentiment that the less you know about where your food comes from, the better. It's sort of, we're ostriching ourselves in some of these things, in some of these ways. When we put our heads in the sand, or we just say we don't want to know about this. And this makes it pretty clear. I mean, we've seen pigs' heads on Top Chef before. We've seen in this season just a whole butchered half cow and a maddened Italian man going to town on it. So it is something that that we're reminded of by Top Chef. And in this particular challenge, I don't think we were really reminded of that. But just looking at the ingredients themselves, it's hard not to be reminded of it when you see them. So that was really difficult for me to deal with. I thought it was interesting what both of the chefs were able to do with the ingredients. And I think we can talk about the success levels, because it seemed like both chefs did really well here, but in different ways.
Yeah. So get to those dishes. Brian decides to go for, he probably has the most experience working with these, obviously because of his butchery experience. He decides to make a puntanesca with the pigtail with mussels, and then Thompson with crispy pig ears and kale. Brandon decides to go for a pig trotter and pigtail crostini, which sounds very interesting, with a celery salad. And much like last challenge, where he decides to go for three slimy ingredients instead of two, he decides to go for three pig parts instead of two, and does crispy pig ears with a pimenton aioli. And to your point, Antonio, Tom says this is probably the closest match that they've had all season on LCK. In fact, maybe two of the best dishes he's had all season. Seems like by far the closest outcome. Brandon ends up squeaking out here by the hair of his chinny chin chin. Kurt, did this come as a surprise to you, this outcome?
No, because I still think that, you know, Brandon's downfall that got him eliminated was, you know, the accidental dumping of the grapeseed oil. It was an accident that led to an unfortunate choice. Whereas, like, if that accident hadn't happened, then I think he would have still been in the competition. So I think Brandon in Last Chance Kitchen, you're seeing a very solid contestant in Last Chance Kitchen. What I think I was more surprised by is the way that Tom was talking about this. And we've often, I think more and more, it seems recently, been having three contestants in Last Chance Kitchen. I was surprised that it wasn't declared both of you will advance, and that for like the remainder of this instance of LCK, we are going to see three chefs in. Maybe there'll be like a double elimination down the road that actually brings two people in from Top Chef proper. But I was actually thinking that we would potentially see both of them advance from LCK into next week.
Yeah, I had that inkling of a thought as well, in terms of, you know, they were both so good. And we've seen instances before where even as many as four people were cooking against each other. So it would not be outside the limit of possibilities for Tom to keep them both through. Haley, who is your winner between the two dishes?
I would probably have to say Brandon, because Tom was right. I feel like the mussel was the star of the dish and not necessarily the pig product in Brian's. So I do think Brandon earned the win there.
Yeah, I would say that I was more attracted to Brian's dish, but that's because I do love mussels. And so
Well, you came to the right place, Mike. They don't call me Haley Strong just because it's on my birth certificate.
For those of you that obviously don't get the video version of this podcast, Haley is flexing right now, just showing off.
Yeah, that's the $20 Patreon level, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
I'm glad you guys laughed at that, because no one has laughed at that in probably a good 2 years.
Well, this has been a line you've been trying out for. That is this your brining? It's just something you keep doing over and over again.
Yeah, no, I use it all the time, because if you don't know, I work at a restaurant, and so the patrons of said restaurant, obviously, they make the same jokes all the time. So, like, why can't I? So whenever somebody's like, oh, my, that's a lot of plates you're carrying, I go, they don't call me Haley Strong just because it's on my birth certificate. And one time, a guy was like, wait, is your dad Greg? And I was like, yes.
So did this man report you to your dad? Is that what you're saying?
No, he was just like, oh, that's weird. I know your dad because of your stupid joke. I wouldn't have known who you are otherwise.
That's a good conversation starter. That's how you network people.
Yeah. I'm sure people are like, you know what? Let's talk to that girl who has terrible jokes at that seafood restaurant we go to every once in a while.
Look, there are worse ways to build a career. So look, it worked on all of us. Hopefully it worked on the audience as well. Anything else we have to say about this episode before we talk about a trip to another state for Top Chef Kentucky, interestingly enough?
It did worry me a little bit that Brian didn't know how to use a pressure cooker, and it seemed like there was a lot of coaching from the peanut gallery. I don't necessarily think that's bad, but I do. One thing we've moved away, we've talked about it in seasons past, is I think Brian made the comment that what Brandon was plating looked cute, but mine looks rustic. And I think we've learned from previous seasons that rustic is Top Chef code for messy. So I didn't know if that was something that was necessarily going to be bragging about. But I think that
makes sense. If you walk through the woods, you're not necessarily seeing decadent things.
Exactly. So I just, this was one of the first times in a while we've had a rustic sighting on Top Chef. And I was like, my ears perked up at that. Not my pig ears, but my actual.
Good, because if they perked up off the plate, I think that's a problem there with not enough time in the pressure cooker. Antonio, can you talk me through the logic of Top Chef Kentucky going to Nashville next episode?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing says Kentucky like leaving the state to have fun, honestly. It's, no,
we're engaging in one of the most tried and true Kentucky traditions, leaving and not coming back.
It's kind of a Top Chef tradition, too, when it comes to some of the, like, you know, we've left the areas before. Like, I think Top Chef California went to, was it, you know, Vegas or has left.
Right,
the state,
but so. That was the finale location. Here we're doing a rare, like, mid-season vacay and then coming back, I'm assuming. Even though I think we might be going to the Philippines for the final task, so I don't know how many episodes we might be spending in Nashville, actually.
One of the things I like about living in Kentucky and where I live is that I'm 4 to 5 hours drive, 4 to 5 hours, not 45, from a lot of great cities. I can go to Chicago. I can go to Nashville. I can go to Detroit. I can go to lots of cities that are in a very close radius. Atlanta's only 6 hours. So it's, I think, representative of Kentucky, which is bordered by 7 states, that you can go a lot of different places within the state in like a day trip or like a day's drive. And so I think it's cool. It is very much, especially a Louisville tradition to go down. I think it's 65, if I'm not mistaken, to just go south from Louisville to Nashville through Bowling Green, where Western Kentucky University is. And so most Kentuckians, especially people from that part of the state and further south, have spent a lot of time in Nashville on weekends, having fun, going for parties. So this is, I think, pretty in keeping with what it's like to be in Kentucky and live in Kentucky. You get to go to Nashville just on a whim. It's not someplace you have to fly to or that it's a really long drive from. I mean, even from me in Cincinnati, it's about 4 hours. And so it's a really easy trip to make by car, and definitely something I've done a lot of the time. I have a really good friend who lives in Franklin, Tennessee, just outside Nashville. And so I've spent a lot of time down there. I know a lot of Kentuckians do the same thing. So I think it's fitting with Kentucky, and hopefully they don't spend more than one episode there. Nashville would be a great locale for a full Top Chef season.
Yeah,
so
that's what I was thinking.
Wonder if they're shooting their shot by having just one episode here, or if we're going to do, you know, if this is just a tease.
Well, then in Top Chef Nashville, then they'll travel to Kentucky for one episode.
Be great.
It's going to be an exchange program.
It's tit for tat. But it's interesting because this episode seems like it might not necessarily be focused on Nashville, but the people in Nashville specifically looks like they're going to the Grand Ole Opry. And the guest judge for one of their challenges is country singer Hunter Hayes. And their elimination challenge, I kid you not, is to cook for the lead singer of Kings of Leon. I never thought that sentence would come out of my mouth in my life, but I guess we're here right now. There also seems to be a lot of tears. I think my best guess is this is our requisite, like, cook a dish that reminds you of someone or something challenge. A challenge that reminds you of the song You Somebody. I'm not entirely sure, but it's going to be very interesting. Haley, we can talk about this next week, but do you have any experience with either Hunter Hayes or the lead singer of Kings of Leon? Is this a pulling from The Bachelor when they would bring in like random country singer to come serenade the couple?
Yeah, I can only imagine Hunter Hayes has done like the anonymous concert on The Bachelor. I'm not super into country music, so I can't say that I definitively know who Hunter Hayes is. I've obviously heard of Kings of Leon, but do I care that their lead singer is on Top Chef? Absolutely not. I guess that's all I have to say about that. Sorry.
Well, we'll have a lot to prepare for next week. I think that to the points that we made before, I think both LCK and the show proper has hit a high note after ending on a bit of a low note last week. Especially, it seems like everyone, for the most part, was cooking at least pretty good food. The judges really liked it across the board. Hopefully that translates well to when they actually change states, but we shall see. Anything else anybody wants to talk about with the episode, LCK, or what's to come in Tennessee before we start tying this up like a nice porchetta?
I want to know who's tending their gardens while they're gallivanting around Cumberland, Nashville. I'm worried about these gardens.
I was actually going to bring, that's funny you bring that up. I was actually, had a quick exchange a couple weeks ago with Brandon on Twitter about that. And he'd been tweeting about how that was actually one of his favorite experiences about Top Chef was getting to do that, you know, daily back at their house, where they had those garden plots that when it was introduced in episode one and kind of dropped. And I thought for sure that was going to be like Chekhov's garden where it was going to like, you know, be a, element of some challenge, like how well you've tended your gardens and been raising those ingredients is going to impact you in episode 5, because that's all you get in terms of spices or something. But yeah, it's like they're leaving the gardens and we've not seen the gardens again. It would be kind of nice if it was incorporated in some way, but I'm just getting a feeling it's one and done.
It's a shame. I would like to see more of that for sure.
Yeah.
There was a couple other quick notes. I like the story about Eric's dad. I thought that was a great story. How he found $10,000 in cash. What do you have? Carmen Sandiego in his cab? Like, what the hell's going on here? Some woman leaves 10K in cash in his cab, but he gives it back. Gets the key to the city. I thought that was great. And so when you mentioned next episode, what are we going to do with a lot of these stories about who people remind people of? A lot of these people we know have a deceased parent. We've heard this now, I think, with Eddie. I know we had heard it with Brian. We've certainly now heard it with Eric. These are stories that we've started to hear on the show already. So I think we're primed for that, if that's where we go with this. Kings of Leon, if I'm not mistaken, I think the whole band is made up of siblings, or at least I think they're all related, and I know they're from the Nashville area, or they were formed in Nashville, so maybe that's going to be part of this down home kind of challenge. Like, they're a band of brothers, if you will, and so cook something that reminds you of a family member. That could be what we do. So I'm looking forward to that. People with shared memories, these shared experiences, like Tom and Davey about the Portuguese Club in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Is that someplace you've been, Mike? Have you been to the Portuguese Club in your now New Jersey residency?
I'm not really. I don't think they let me into a country club. I'm the person.
It's literally a club dedicated to a country, is what you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, I literally dress like Brian does right before he gets in a hot tub. So I don't know if I exactly have the wardrobe becoming of a member, but I do love those random tidbits as well. David brought up in the very first episode that he wants to be the second most well-known chef from Elizabeth, New Jersey, and I love the little connection they had there. Could you imagine when Dave's like, I cooked this thing from when Tom went to, you know, Tom's very first restaurant, just to really, like, I don't know, make Tom cry and make him really enjoy the dish. That would be an interesting strategy to implement.
Hit us up if you've been to the Portuguese Club in Elizabeth, New Jersey. I'm curious what that's like. I had like yacht club in my mind. I did not have country club, but you're right, Kurt. There's a country right in the name, so that's probably on point. The only other thing, I thought it was really funny when Sarah asked Eddie, are you going to take your wife and kid to Italy? And he's like, I guess so.
I guess I have to now. Eddie just sort of like, I don't know, what should I do? What do you think I should do?
But to be fair, he had just learned 5 minutes before, so
yeah, we could defend Eddie.
See, I was picturing like a kind of a hole-in-the-wall restaurant, like very authentic, welcoming, warm, like for the Portuguese club. I wasn't picturing a country club.
Neither was I. I thought the same thing, but like a yacht club, like just kind of like a weird, you know, like a, just a boat club where you could steal oysters off the grill and no one would care. Like, I thought it was that kind of place too. So who knows? I want to hear from the listeners. If you've been to the Portuguese Club, let us know what it's like. So yeah, other than that, I like that Susan, or I like that Sarah named the boat Susan, because that's my mom's name. That's
aww. That's lovely. And I'm also looking things up. And it looks like, doesn't really look like a country club. So maybe I will have to make a trip to the Portuguese club and do some recon there. Because it seems like a lovely edifice to hopefully step into.
It looks like a big banquet hall.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Like, they were talking about these events that take place there. I thought it was more of like a big, like, annual event setting that everyone knows about, but maybe they just happen to attend the same event. I'm not entirely sure, but it's an interesting connection. And we'll talk much more about connections next week as Top Chef sails along here. To finish things off, let's go around the horn if you want to give out your social media handle and talk about what you're speaking about either in podcast form or on social media in general. Kurt, let's start with you.
I really don't have much going on from a podcaster podcast perspective. Social media, I'm always all over the place. I would say, though, just as I guess if I want to do kind of like one-off recommendations, recently I was listening to the Sporkful podcast, and there was a recent Sporkful episode on Is the Future of Bourbon Female, where they kind of talk about the history of bourbon and speak to kind of its growth with its roots in Kentucky, and just to kind of learn how that's growing and how that's evolving. So just in terms of people are kind of interested in what we've been talking about here in terms of Kentucky and food, I'd recommend the Sporkful podcast. Their recent episode is The Future of Bourbon Female. But you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Kurt Clark with two C's.
All right, let's move over to the grandmaster of bourbon himself, Antonio. What have you got going on?
Well, first of all, if somebody has the Jiggle Juice recipe, hit me up at AC Mazzaro on Twitter or Instagram. I don't really use Insta that much, but I make bourbon slush with black tea, but this was like a peach mint black tea. Mm-hmm. Sounded really good. So definitely hit me up for that. No, I recommend that everyone listen to Mike's Drag Race podcast. Speaking of like the food in Last Chance Kitchen, Brandon's food had the ooh, ah, ah sensation, Mike. And I think that's why it wins. And I really enjoy the podcast. I'm enjoying this season. So I would give a shout out for that podcast. Give a shout to you and Liana and Brett. I'm having a good time with that. Other than that, no, I listened to Haley's Bachelor podcast as well. Haley, what's going on?
So a couple of weeks ago, you guys had Jim on, and I was so disappointed to miss him. I love talking to Jim. And so he reached out to me this week and said, hey, like, I'd love to talk Bachelor with you guys. So he's going to come on the Bachelor podcast this week.
Yes!
I'm so excited.
That is incredible.
And he told me he has run into one of the contestants a few times. So I'm so excited to hear about it.
Yeah, Jim has this really interesting connection. Like he I know he has a connection to a Bachelor contestant. He also went to high school with Bobby John from Survivor. So, like,
what?
Take the point that he made a couple weeks ago about how entrenched he is in the reality TV community. It is much deeper than you initially think. How has the season been so far?
It's been pure shit, honestly. It's been so boring.
Ring it's been endorsement.
Yeah, it's been really slow, but hopefully it'll pick up. And I'm so excited Jim's going to come on and talk to us about The Bachelor. He was one of my people who I was like, you know what, I would really like to get him on sometime this season. So I'm so glad that he's going to come on. Other than that, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at hstrong_, and my blog is strongtakes.ca.
And Haley, I apologize about asking you how many pig parts you put in your mouth. That was unbecoming of a podcast.
You're going to be hearing from my lawyer.
Can I be your lawyer, Haley?
Antonio will reach out to me after the show. Well, thank you, Antonio. I appreciate the plug for the Drag Race podcast. And this LCK was a brown pick stunning. So I really enjoyed it in so many ways. You can always follow me at a Mike Bloom type. You can check out the exit press I do every week for Top Chef on Parade. I spoke with Brandon this past week. He gave me his insight as to what exactly happened with the grapesoodle and the xanthan gum of it all, as well as his own perspectives about, as he said in the beginning of the show, not wanting to come off as the quote-unquote cocky guy. He gave a lot of interesting perspective into that. I should hopefully have a conversation with Brian up in the next few days as well. Also on Parade, I'm doing Celebrity Big Brother coverage.
Oh boy.
That it has been a messy season so far. I actually went on the podcast last night with Taryn and Rob to talk through the suspect circumstances that befell one Anthony Scaramucci's fate on that show. That will still be highly debated, I think, in the futures of reality TV history.
It's dumb. It's dumb. There's no conspiracy.
That's pretty cheap.
Go ahead, Mike. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm also, speaking of conspiracy or a show that had a great episode called Conspiracy Once Upon a Time, I'm covering Star Trek Discovery for The Hollywood Reporter. And this week I got to talk with Commander Riker himself, Jonathan Frakes, who directed the most recent episode. You can check out all the stuff I'm doing with that at thr.com/Star Trek Discovery. But that's going to do it this week for our Top Chef Judges Roundtable podcast. Thank you all so much for listening. Some conglomeration of us will be back next week to talk through the Chef Teston's trip to Nashville, where the music and tears will flow. But for now, you may pack your knives and go.